Okay, well, so I left my slide count to be kind of purposefully on the light side, because I was hoping we could trigger some discussion and talk about what really interesting stuff we can do in the future. We're down to a pretty small group, but hopefully discussion can still be lively. But first, to set the stage a little bit, this is an old plot from before we had, the figure was made before we had any detections, but it was accepted before we had any binary neutron star detections. But it was kind of trying to highlight what kinds of constraints we could expect for neutron stars, due primarily to the limitations from the mass-spin degeneracy, specifically mass ratio and spin. So this is just showing 5 out of 200 events that we simulated and then constrained with our typical parameter estimation tools. We simulated these events between 1.2 and 1.6 solar masses for the component masses, and with spins below 0.05, so kind of following the galactic kind of picture that we have of binary neutron star systems. And these regions here are showing the 95% credible intervals in component masses. So basically just showing you kind of the picture that we have now of GW170817, where we constrain the chirp mass very well, which is kind of driving the width of this banana. And then we constrain the mass ratio very poorly, which is kind of deciding the extent of the banana, particularly away from equal mass in this case, because all of our systems are pretty close to equal mass that we simulated. The bars here are showing the various choices you can make a priori about the spin limits of neutron stars. So up here is letting spins go all the way to 1, and then as you put progressively more strict priors on the maximum spin of neutron stars, then you can work down your constraint on masses, because you're putting a constraint on mass ratio as well. And so there is 0.7, here is 0.4, and then down here is 0, which is effectively the 0.05 limit that we've used for GW170817 for one of the sets of constraints that we provide. So that's to say that unless you are putting in, if you think that spins of neutron stars could go up to something like 0.7, where a breakup typically happens for most equations of state, the choice on exactly how far you let it get to, how close you let it get to 0.7, doesn't really drive your mass ratio too much. And it's not until you get to more dramatic restrictions on spin, like 0.05 or something, that you really get a sizable constraint on masses. I mean, obviously all this is important, but this is just kind of laying the picture of where we kind of expected things to be before we detected GW170817.
Thank you. So let's just do spin 0 for a minute.
Yep.
Zero spin. I'm trying to, I mean, to me that's the right limit to be in.
Yes.
The first event, I mean, obviously you could get weird events.
Yeah.
We have a lot of them. So the heavy line here is for the chirp mass, for, you've added this to the old plot.
Added this, what do you mean, added this to the...
That's for the chirp mass of the...
This line, so this is showing, this is actually a box. It's a two-dimensional 95%
yeah.
credible interval.
And
the way that I actually generated it, because coming up with contours that are this thin in component mass space is really hard. So actually defining a two-dimensional rectangle in chirp mass ratio space and projecting that onto M1, M2. But the idea is that basically we constrain the chirp mass better than we could ever need it to be constrained. And so the next thing to think about is what can we do, how can we get better estimates of masses in the future? And it's not so much SNR, because it's really the SNR is driving the width of that banana, and getting that to a higher precision isn't going to be very helpful. It's really dealing with this mass ratio spin degeneracy. And there are some ways that we can break that. I mean, in the binary black hole case, or...
Well, that's what I'm asking. So why would you call it a mass ratio spin degeneracy if I tell you the spin's zero?
Oh, so...
Spin is zero.
Okay, so you're saying constraining here then. Okay, yeah, so that obviously we've removed the degeneracy in that case. That's right.
Okay.
So yeah, if you're already saying that from astrophysics you don't expect spins to go above 0.05, then yeah, that's right. We've basically taken the degeneracy out of the picture.
Right. There's still a wide range of parameters for Q that you can get.
That's right, and so then that's going to be somewhat SNR dominated, I guess. Yeah, so you can see the variations in the from here to here to here. Some of those variations are probably due to SNR. Some of them are due to just the details of the signal and orientation and things. That's right. Where we can also do very well is in the neutron star black hole case. Because there we have the potential for some sizable spin on the black hole, and specifically misalignments can give us precession. Right. And then we can lighten up our constraints, our prior constraints on spin, and use that breaking of the degeneracy to kind of precisely estimate most of the parameters. So a precessing neutron star black hole case would really be a slam dunk for estimating parameters without putting in strong priors in the first place.
So a different question. It seems from this plot and also from this event that all the 90% contours are sort of go all the way up to consistent with Q equals 1. Is there ever a case where you will be able to say that, you know, it's definitively less than 1.9 or?
Yeah, so this is, I mean, in this case here, we used much wider priors than our simulations were actually spread over. And so here we have these kind of bananas that all have, they move away from 1. And specifically the way we draw them, or the way that we have drawn them, is that we are effectively taking the lower 90% bound on mass ratio. So we are basically taking the upper 90% probability all the way up until 1, because they're always, so far we've always had strong posterior support at 1. And so your question is, could we ever hope to meaningfully constrain away from 1? And so far we haven't been able to do that. Even for the binary black hole cases where we've got a bunch of events, they're all consistent with equal mass so far.
What physical parameters does that depend on? Like what would?
Like in a population synthesis sense?
Just an SNR thing?
No, well, I mean, so it's, at this point, it's probably at least partly driven for binary black holes by astrophysics, that we tend, it seems that the universe likes to produce equal mass things, which is kind of what we expected from population synthesis results too. But as far, yeah, so I mean, part of it is just that we have a very poor constraint on mass ratio, and so unless we move far away from the equal mass boundary in the first place, it's going to be hard to constrain in the systems far away from 1. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's partly SNR driven, but I mean it's just the limitation. Our statistical uncertainties are just never going to be able to constrain away from 1 if all of the systems are kind of piling up roughly in that equal mass.
Yeah.
Kind of
so
line.
All
right, so this is the picture for GW170817, and then these are the two spin limits that we've been talking about. And just to say that this is basically the picture that we had kind of expected for mass ratio.
So again, I just want to parse this, because
yes.
I haven't read 100 papers yet. So again, if I stick to my bias, I guess it's the right way to say it, I should still have it in the blue.
Yes.
And if I set it to 0, it's basically the same as 0.05.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. So then, if I want to say that, then the M2, yeah, so then those are fine, yeah. So you almost, yeah.
That's right, you mean by fine, you mean we're not going below like 1 solar mass.
Exactly.
Stars. Yeah.
You're not getting a weird,
yeah.
You're not getting a weird neutron star.
That's right.
It's 1.2-ish, right?
That's right, yeah, so everything seems pretty yeah. Rosy.
Why does it cut off at 1.37?
1.37, sorry, what are you looking at?
I'm just looking at the histogram.
The top of the boundary.
Oh, this is just the equal mass boundary. So we define M1 and M2 so that M1 is the more massive. So
we
restrict that part of the parameter space just from how we define M1, M2. Okay, so just to talk about now where some of these constraints come from. This is how we get strain from the predicted H plus H cross, the two polarizations of gravitational waves. Fs are the antenna patterns. So that takes into account sky position, polarization angle, and things that project the H plus H cross onto our actual detector. And specifically, the waveform that we used in the first discovery paper is this kind of stationary phase approximation waveform, Taylor F2. If you use the stationary phase approximation, you get these kinds of forms for H plus and H cross. And the things to note here are that the amplitude depend on the chert mass here, that combination of masses that we're sensitive to. We go the amplitude scales like f to the minus 7/6. That's the pretty typical power law waveform that we always look at. And then the phase information is all here in the psi f. And that's where the tidal terms that we typically constrain come into account. So down here is that phased expansion for Taylor F2. And it's specifically the psi tidal, where the tidal terms come in, that we're trying to constrain here, that's new from the binary black hole case. And so these are the parameters that we typically talk about. There's this component deformation, which takes into account the Love number and the radius of the neutron star. So these are the lambda 1s and lambda 2s that we let vary completely independently for the two components in the binary. But the leading order in the post-Newtonian expansion that goes into that phase term that I showed on the last slide is this lambda tilde here. And so it's this combination of masses and lambdas that is the leading order contribution to the phase term. And so if you want to talk about what we constrain best as far as tidal parameters go, it's this lambda tilde. It's just like the effective spin that we talk a lot about with binary black holes, where it's this combination, it's the mass-weighted combination of the aligned components of the spins of the objects that we typically constrain best. And that's the thing that enters at the highest order. For lambdas, it's this lambda tilde parameter here. Okay, so then what is the effect of these tidal parameters on the waveform? It turns out it's very hard to affect the phasing of gravitational waves. You need to put in a whole lot of energy to cause a 10 to the minus 3 shift in, a 10 to the minus 3 radian shift in the phasing of the waveform. And so dumping in, you need to dump in a whole lot of energy into tidal excitation to have any kind of detectable effect on the waveforms. And so it really only starts to accumulate and dominate in the last few cycles of the in-spiral leading up to the merger. And another way to look at this is now taking the integrand to the SNR, and it's trying to separate out the various post-Newtonian contributions. And so you can do this in a special way that gives you a picture of where your various parameters are getting constrained in terms of frequency range. And so here is the chirp mass. So this is basically showing you that we're constraining the chirp mass at the lowest frequencies. So you just accumulate a ton of cycles, you get some small changes in the frequency evolution, and that gives you this chirp mass early on in the in-spiral. After that, you start to measure the mass ratio. Here, they use the symmetric mass ratio eta. And then towards the kind of the bucket of the sensitivity curve of LIGO around the 100 hertz region, that's where we're accumulating a lot of SNR. And then it's not up until very high frequencies where you start putting in these tidal constraints. So it's really just the last little bits before the signal gets buried in shot noise that we're trying to do this constraint of tidal parameters. And so this is the picture that we have from 170817. And we, again, use the two different spin priors. And it's a bit counterintuitive, perhaps, that the high spin prior gives you better constraints on tides. But that's just this the fact that these are marginalized posterior distributions. So it's integrating over uncertainty in all of the other parameters, including masses. So when you open up the spin prior, then you get much broader posteriors for mass ratio, and then that starts to isolate kind of these various tidal parameters. And so and just like how we can constrain spin, you get this lambda one when you start making it the primary object much more massive. It starts to have a bigger imprint on the waveform than the secondary object, and so the constraints get tighter for that. But we've put on here these kind of pictures of a few choice equations of state, and we start to rule out some of them from these kinds of constraints. But one obvious improvement we could do here is we can actually fold in the fact that both of these objects probably have the same equation of state. Right now, we just vary these lambdas, which I showed you how they added into the phase on a previous slide. But we just vary them independently. We say that they have priors that are completely independent of one another. So there's nothing tying the two together. And so instead, use the various proposed equations of state to put constraints on all of these and just do model selection between all the various equations of state. We could think about doing a parametric description of the equation of state and using that to basically make a hierarchical model where we can put general constraints on just what the equation of state looks like.
I'm just staring at the right plot.
Yep.
Right? So if I'm understanding your colors and your dashed lines, you have no measurement of the tidal effect. Is the claim?
No measurement of the tidal effect.
You have a constraint.
We have an upper limit.
And I guess what I'd like to know most is what is the radius of the H4 equation of state?
What is the radius of the H4 equation of state?
Yeah,
I don't know that.
Because, I mean, again, it's I'm just concerned that, most of the things you're ruling out are things we've already ruled out based on radii.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, that's right. I think.
Some set. I mean, not to demean what you've done.
No.
It's like, both of this we know,
That's right.
It's a different measurement. I get it. But,
yeah.
But you know, those EOSs, I said, are really big and puffing. Huh?
It's about 14.
About 14, yeah. Right. So the MPA one is still allowed.
Still allowed. Yeah, that's
12
right.
12 and a half.
12 and a half. Exactly. Yeah. Right. And so, but you know, the typical radii, I haven't done this for 10 years, at least 10 years ago, or 10 to 12. I mean, you just had this in your plot.
Yes.
So maybe the rule, so let me frame it as a question,
yep.
Which is obviously if you don't increase the high frequency, if you don't decrease the high frequency noise,
yep.
This is not going to get any better.
Well, it can potentially get better. So that's where hierarchical analyses would come in handy, because then you're having a bunch of independent measurements of potentially the same equation of state. If you assume all neutron stars are following the same equation of state, then you can kind of effectively stack these.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
So there's hope there. Okay. I mean, it's hard to say which will be better. Maybe we'll be even more lucky than a 40 megaparsec binary, or maybe we'll be just as lucky in the future with a 40 megaparsec binary, but with better sensitivity.
Yeah, fair enough.
So there's some hope here. And so that's really one of the reasons why we want to move toward a more physical description of the parameter space, basically.
The move away from these. You could have made this plot, a version of this plot,
mm-hmm.
with R1, R2.
Yeah.
And have it be R1, R2 at 1.3 solar masses.
Yep.
Something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
This parameter just, I mean, I know what it is, but it's not.
That's right. Yeah. So it's a little more interpretable.
Right?
Well, not exactly, but yeah, you can.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Point taken. Yeah. And the other thing to note here is that this is just using this Taylor F2 description of tides. And so we have more sophisticated models that have been tuned to numerical relativity simulations. And we picked this waveform because it was something that we had easily usable and in our experience has been conservative. So the hope is that more sophisticated models, including more physics, will put slightly tighter constraints on this. But it's unlikely to change the picture drastically. We're probably going to need more events in stacking to be able to start making these constraints more meaningful. So that kind of takes me to what we've already started talking about, which is what we can do next. More sophisticated waveform models being used on the same data set, more physically motivated parameterizations that can kind of lend themselves to this stacking approach to doing a hierarchical analysis and combining information from future events as well. But I mean, there's also something to be extracted from the distribution of other binary neutron star mergers. So that's something we've talked a lot about in the binary black hole case of looking at spin distributions that start isolating formation channels between globular clusters and field formation, and looking at for imprints on the kind of rate as a function of mass and things. And there hasn't been a whole lot of discussion that I've at least heard talking about what kind of features we could hope to find in the distribution of binary neutron star systems and what kind of physical processes that might be leading to their formation could be kind of teased out of that kind of data set. And so that's something I'm kind of interested in discussing more, if there is something enticing there. But
so if you could go back to the waveform plot where you showed that
one?
Yeah.
With the
so
there.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So I guess my main question is, so you're down to maybe 10 or 15 cycles, right? It looks like by the time you're starting to see tidal effects. So the parameterization you're using is the static tide.
That's right.
Parameterization, right? And that worries me.
Yep.
How do you convince yourself? I mean, I guess what I'm wondering is it would be nice to have some way of just saying, we've seen a tidal effect.
Right, to rule out lambdas of zero.
Exactly.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, that would be nice.
So is there some way, because it's getting, given the uncertainties in the physics,
mm-hmm.
it's looking more formal than it should be, if you see what I'm saying, that it would be better to have a characterization of saying the waveform didn't match that of point sources.
Right, yeah, no, that right. It would be so nice to be able to say from the gravitational wave data that we've certainly detected neutrons.
Finite,
yeah,
finite
yeah,
extent.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes.
So is there, I mean, to me, that is a question about, is that a more fruitful approach, given that that might be all you can ever do? You're not going to measure it, because the minute you say you've measured it, nobody's going to debate you about the static tide.
Yeah.
So any inferences you make from the measurement are going to be muddled.
Yeah.
Right. So
but I mean, I don't see how we can really go about trying to make that measurement in any different of a way than we've already gone about.
No, so I'm trying to frame it a different way, which is you could, if you could say for this event,
yep.
and confidence, we know that it was not two point sources.
Mm-hmm. And we can't. That's what these.
No, not for this one. But
okay.
But I'm saying
for future ones.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Some, I mean, to me, that might be all you ever get to do.
Right.
So the question is there a different approach statistically you take to it? Because now you're just ruling. You're just basically saying deviation from a waveform that you know extremely well.
Yeah.
So I would think you'd have a more stringent ability to say that than it's these love numbers.
Right. So I mean, I think that the hope is, so I don't think there's any magic we can do in the late in spiral. I mean, it's just how the tidal deformations come into the in spiral, right? I mean,
the
kind of merger to post-merger part when tidal disruption happens might be an interesting thing that we can try to pull out.
But if somebody tells me they measured the lambda,
mm-hmm.
right, then my interpretation of that will be you've shown it's not a point source.
Right, that's correct. Yes.
I'm not going to believe the radius because you know it's the first term in the expansion ones included.
Right. No, our original hope was that for this event we would at least be able to rule out lambda zero. That would have been the most exciting thing we could have done, but we can't.
Right, because you can imagine mass ratios where we start to worry that one's a black hole.
Right, that's right.
So what about that exercise? So the same exercise, but where you're doing neutron star black hole. So only one has a tidal opportunity.
Mm-hmm. When we start moving to more massive things like neutron star black hole binaries, we're going to have a hard time because of our inability to constrain mass ratio in most cases. We probably won't know for sure whether it was a binary black hole system or a neutron star black hole system. Potentially measuring a non-zero tide for the secondary object would be one way to break that. Or having an EM counterpart, you could claim would also lead you to make that statement. But
black holes can have tides. Right. I don't know. Maybe they're just much smaller than the neutron star tides.
What we call tides are kind of. I mean, you can think of there being tidal excitation of the event horizon, but it doesn't change the dynamics here of what you get with just taking the two point source.
For the waveform.
Yeah, and they're extremely more compact than neutron stars as well. So it's just a completely different order of magnitude effect, but.
We discussed this briefly, but how strong would the magnetic field have to be in order to modify the waveform?
I think it would have to be really high, right? I mean, that's part of it is that.
Dynamical. Well,
10^18, some crazy.
Really? Because it's, if it's, let's say it's 10^46, isn't that more reasonable is it really that?
Wait, you want the magnetic field to affect the dynamics of the
spiral, yeah. It could be stress in the magnetosphere. It doesn't have to be dynamical magnetic field.
Yeah, there was some crude stuff done on that. There was some crude stuff. They're big numbers. They're not magnetars. It's way bigger than magnetars.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So bigger than ever.
Bigger than anything we've seen.
But, so the post-merger is something that we did try to do some constraints on. I'm not a huge fan of how the collaboration went about putting those constraints on the post-merger signal. You can kind of come at that problem in two different ways. And the problem that the approach that's currently that was in the paper that was released along with the discovery paper was to treat it almost like a search. To use the kind of burst pipelines to do a search. And that really kind of throws out the fact that we already know the signal pretty well leading up to the merger. And so you can think of it as doing kind of a signal reconstruction effort associated with your normal constraint. And so that's something that is currently in the pipeline. And will give us slightly better constraints, I think, than what the search upper limits we have released so far are. But
is that one you also see being able to do by stacking?
I think it's going to be a little more difficult just because the post-merger stuff is really messy. We rely totally on numerical simulations to extract it. And so in order to do the stacking, we need to have some kind of parameters that are going to be consistent from event to event. And I don't know if we have a good enough understanding of what the post-merger signal looks like and how it depends on the parameters of the binary to be able to stack them up.
Cool. Did you have more slides on your next, or was it?
No. Okay, that's it. That's it. Just wanted some discussion. It's been really good. Great.
Cool.